Exploring the veteran artists from pop, rock, soul, country, folk, and blues. This is the VVN Music Podcast. Today's program is brought to you by VVN Music. Get the latest news on artists who have been recording for two decades or more every day at VVNmusic.com. Hi, and welcome to episode 15 of the VVN Music Podcast. I'm Roger Wenk, and today we're talking with Canadian metal queen Lee Aaron. Born Karen Greenig, she first got into music while still in high school when she was asked to join a band named Lee Aaron. She adopted the name as her own and recorded her first album, The Lee Aaron Project, in 1982. The album sold well in Canada, along with the United Kingdom, where, even though it was never officially released, it gained a fairly large following just through import sales. She followed in 1984 with Metal Queen, which included the single of the same name that became a bit of an anthem for her career. Lee later recorded a number of albums for Attic Records through the 80s and early 90s before striking out with her own label. By the late 90s, Aaron changed direction, exploring blues and jazz music, and recorded the pop-jazz hybrid disc Beautiful Things in 2004. Earlier this year, Lee released her first album in 12 years, Fire and Gasoline, a return to the world of rock. Hey, congratulations on the new album. Is it available in both Canada and the United States right now?
It is. I mean, I can't promise you exactly which, you know, brick-and-mortar stores you'd be able to find it. I don't have all those details. I know that it is available through Caroline Universal in the U.S., whatever, I guess, networks they have for distribution. But I know that it's readily available, and most people shop online these days at Amazon.com. So all you got to do is go online, and it's there. Yeah, I mean, it is available down there.
You know, you said, and I think it was around a mid-2000s interview, that the Metal Queen is officially retired. So what happened that you decided to move back into rock music?
Well, I think that comment, more than anything, was a response to the fact that when I made a shift and I sang jazz for a little while, and I wouldn't say it was the majority of fans, but certainly a small contingent, there was a fair amount of hostility toward me for not just sort of wearing that crown forever, you know? And the truth be known, I felt somewhat trapped by it, especially, you know, a lot of the real diehard metal fans, you know, expected me to continue to make that album over and over and over again. And that's just not the kind of artist that I am. You know, for lack of a better comparison, and don't get me wrong, I am not comparing myself to David Bowie, but David Bowie kind of changed and reinvented and shifted styles on almost every record that he did. But the consistent thread throughout the thing was that no matter if it shifted slightly stylistically, what made it David Bowie was his voice and the fact that the material was still written by that writer. And, you know, I kind of look at my body of work like that. So I think that comment you're talking about was more of a response to me feeling like, you know, I should be allowed to step outside of that box and be able to perform whatever style of music I choose to, free of judgment.
I think that's understandable. And the thing is that obviously your new album is very up-to-date sounding. It's still rock, but it's very up-to-date sounding. It's not like you return to your 80s roots as far as production and arrangements and things like that.
No, you know, in the past couple of years, I've kind of, I wouldn't say been hounded, so to speak, but on three or four occasions, I have been approached by one particular European label that has asked me would I consider doing like an 80s rock record again, like, you know, with it's sort of like a house writer that they have working within the label that sort of does this with a few different artists, because they trust that this writer producer puts out this sort of, how do I explain it, cookie cutter product that they know will sell over there. And several times I have declined invitations to be a guest artist on one of these records and or to do a complete album that way, because it's just not where I'm at, you know, artistically. You know, when I decided I was going to make Fire and Gasoline, I always knew I would make another rock record. I just didn't know exactly when, because a few things happened throughout the course of my life and my career. In the 90s, the mid-90s, it was very difficult for anybody whose name was attached to commercial rock or AOR rock to get arrested with the advent of grunge. And then I had made a shift in the late 90s, early 2000s, to exploring a different, it's not even a different genre of music. In my mind, what I was doing was going backwards and researching the roots of rock and roll. And that was, I mean, I'm still doing it all the time, but it was just such a great experience for me in terms of discovering all these old, jazz and blues artists that really, this is where rock and roll evolved out of. So I think a lot of those influences I brought forward with me when I decided to make Fire and Gasoline, and I think that you can hear them throughout the record, but it's still a rock album.
The thing is that, and you mentioned this with Bowie and so forth, but there are a lot of other artists who have gone back and explored their roots or have gone back even farther. I mean, not to get into the hundreds of artists who have decided that they are standard singers, but you know, even an Eric Clapton has gone back and visited his blues roots and so forth. So why shouldn't you be able to?
Well, exactly. Well, because Eric Clapton was never entrenched or iconized in the metal world. And there, if that makes any sense, because so I think that his fans were probably a little more receptive to him being able to do that. I have to say the majority of my fans were. I'd say 90% of my fans went along for the ride, and they really embraced it. And even to this day, I incorporate a couple of those, you know, kind of raunchy blues numbers into my set, and people love it. They love, love, love it. But like I said, there was just a certain small percentage of people that liked my music that just had a real difficulty with me doing that. But I agree with you. Why shouldn't I be able to go do that? And I'll qualify this. When I took my diversion into singing jazz and blues, it wasn't Leo and throws out an album of standards. I did one album in 2000, and it was these were songs that I'd fallen in love with, but they were not by any stretch of the imagination overdone standards. They were kind of like treasures that had not been covered a million times that I found, because I thought that was far more interesting than, nobody wants to hear Lee Aaron sing My Funny Valentine one more time.
Oh, I agree, and I didn't mean to imply at all that that's what you had done. I'm just saying that so many had. But no, it's wonderful to go back and try and pull out lost gems, because that's exactly what they are, gems, and they're going to be lost to time if people don't record them and get them back out in the market again.
Oh, I agree. I don't know why we're talking so much about this, but yeah, I still find it fascinating. I found an old Sarah Vaughan song called Tell Him I Said Hello, and it's heartbreaking, and I haven't heard anybody ever cover it. I'm just trying to think of another one. There was a song Dinah Washington did in the 40s called TV is the Thing This Year, and it's quite a fun, upbeat blues number, and it was all about how TV was the cutting-edge technology. And I found that there was just quite an irony in that, because that's what we're experiencing these days with, you know, a generation growing up with, you know, handheld devices, right? So, and that was a song that I chose to cover. No one had covered it. And I thought, this is absolutely modern day, right, in terms of the message.
As far as the new album goes,
yeah,
you wrote the entire album either yourself or co-writing with your guitarist, Sean Kelly. Was
That's
getting
correct.
Back to songwriting hard after not being away for so long, or were you continually doing that over the years between your last album of original material?
Well, no, I wasn't deep in the throes of songwriting, I have to say, because I found once I had my children in 2004 and 2006, I have a daughter and a son, that I was quite shocked at the amount of creative energy that raising children actually does take. So my songwriting at that throughout those years were running into the bathroom, locking myself in while little people banged on the door going, "Mom," and I'd be recording an idea into my iPhone memo feature on my phone. So I had sort of all these fragments of ideas that I didn't have time to sit down and actually create full-fledged songs out of, because that does require quite a bit of focused energy. But the last couple of years, they just sort of went over this hump of maturity, both my son and my daughter, where some time and space opened up. They're far more independent, and I was able to find that time.
And you probably had to go back and listen to those snippets and weed out the ones that sounded like something that came off Sesame Street also.
Oh, yeah. I remember listening back and going, "Oh my gosh, well, I don't know what I was thinking that night, but that one's out the window and this one's in." And then Sean and I bounced back and forth a few ideas as well. And so Sean co-wrote 5 songs and I wrote 6 on my own. But it is like riding a bicycle. When I got back into it, working on it, and now I have tools that I also didn't have, you know, 12 years ago. I have like a demo studio, so that I hadn't had time to really explore using. And so just having the ability to go down there and program up a drum beat and like pretty much create an entire song on my own, you know, I would play all the parts myself. And mind you, they would be played much better by the professionals in my band later. But, you know, I was able to put things down quickly and to put together the skeleton of an idea and go, okay, here's a song, and it's finished. So I found the writing process actually easier than before because I have better tools now.
You mentioned going in and playing the instruments and so forth. And I know that early on when you were still a child, when you were still learning music and so forth, you played a number of different instruments. Are you still fairly proficient, at least, in a number of different ones?
Well, I haven't picked up a saxophone in about 20 years, and I used to play sax when I was younger in a jazz band and a concert band. Whether that would be like riding a bicycle again, I'm not sure. You might hear a few squawks and squeals out of that. You know, what I like to say is that I play a little bit of keyboards and a little bit of guitar and a little bit of bass. I'm not very good on any of them. I would never, ever claim to be a maestro on anything. But I play well enough to put down an idea. And then I hand it to my band and I say, okay, here it is. These are the you know, bass notes I played. But if you have better ideas than me, by all means, bring them into pre-production. You know, sometimes I get stuck on something where I go, okay, you know that sort of signature guitar line thing that I played? I'm hearing that as a background part, and that is the part I want you to play. But I usually hand it off to someone who plays it far better than me. I did play a little guitar on this album, but I guess what I'm trying to say, I'm not trying to be overly humble, but no, I'm not an amazing player, I think, of anything. But I think that in a weird way, that works to my advantage because when I'm writing, I am able to just go, okay, these are the basic chords. And then my singer's brain goes, oh, and this is a great top line to put on top of that. And I can sing it on top. And I don't get stuck like a lot of really proficient players do on, you know, what's going to be the transitional little line that I'm going to play before I go into this next part, or I'm not really liking that snare sound. I'm going to spend 3 hours coming up with a better snare sound. I'm just like, no, let's just get the idea down. Let's get the basic chord structure. Then let's take it and refine it. And let's refine it and make it better. Like in a song like Tomboy, I remember that I had written that chorus, but I didn't really know what I heard the guitar doing in the background. And it took me a few days myself before I came up with the that sort of part. And when I came up with it, I went and I locked into it. I was like, okay, that's the part that I want Sean to play. And then I was able to give it to him, and he just played it far better than me. That's all.
Back in the mid-90s, you had left your original record company, and you started your own label. Did that give you a feeling of a lot more freedom than what you had before?
Yes. But I'd like to say this in a way, it's not a criticism. It's just the way things were in the 80s and the nature of the big record contract, the big record deal, was when you signed a record contract and were a direct label signing, and basically your record company becomes your investor. And if someone's going to invest $500,000 in you, well, then they're going to have an opinion about the way your music should turn out. And that opinion usually transcends into areas like who's going to produce your record, the songs that are going to make it onto the final cut of the album, how you're going to look when they're going to market you. So all along the way during those years, and it was, like I said, it's not a criticism of my label. If I was investing in $500,000 in somebody on one album, I would definitely want to have something to say about the outcome of the final product. But all along the way, I felt like I was making little compromises here and there because that's just the nature of the industry back then. So yes, when I went independent, it's like, wow, now I can just wear whatever I want. The songs that I feel are the best to be the final cut on the album will end up on there. I can hire who I want. In 94, when I did the Emotional Rain album, I was like, okay, I'm going to get that guy from Knox Chandler from the Psychedelic Furs and Reeves Gabrel from David Bowie's Tin Machine. These were people I wanted to work with, and I was able to do that. And so, yeah, it was definitely, there was more artistic freedom, and I think that I personally feel very proud of a lot of those albums that I did in the 90s. Even if they were not as commercially successful as some of the stuff that I did in the 80s. But we must remember again that the whole trends of music had shifted, and that impacted a lot of artists whose names were associated with the late 80s and that era of AOR rock music.
Yeah, everything sort of changed when grunge came along.
That's correct. But I loved grunge. I embraced it. I did a couple of albums in 94 and again in 96 that were definitely had some alt overtones, for sure.
Now, you have continued to record for your own label right up until this latest album, correct?
That's correct.
And the other thing I know is that you also produced this album. Is that something that you have done right along since you started your own label?
No, but I had always been involved in the production process, even when I was on under a record contract as well. My guitar player co-writer years ago was a gentleman named John Albaney, and he loved the whole idea of production and becoming a producer. So we often worked in tandem with another producer on the album, but John always took production credit, which was fine with me because production was a profession that he was heading into in the future. And I guess my attitude at that time was, I'm Lee Aaron. I don't need to be producer too. But as things progressed, I've produced my last three albums. So I produced my jazz effort in 2000, and I produced Beautiful Things in 2004, and I produced this Fire and Gasoline as well. And Fire and Gasoline is probably my first full-fledged rock effort that I produced on my own. But I knew what I wanted.
We'll return to our interview with Lee Aaron in just a minute. VVN Music is your destination for the latest news on the veteran artists of pop, rock, soul, country, folk, and blues who have been recording for 20 years or more. While the world is transfixed on the latest from Rihanna and Drake, VVN Music concentrates on those artists that have proven to have the talent and stamina to still be active well into their careers. Not only does VVN Music have the latest news, but you'll also find charts from around the world focusing on the performance of these veterans, flashbacks to earlier days in music, a schedule for when artists will be on TV, and a calendar of their upcoming releases. For 10 years, VVN Music has gone where most music sites don't, keeping you up to date on the hitmakers from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s. That's VVNMusic.com. Have you been together with your current band for a while, or have you picked up some new players for this particular album?
Well, John Cody is my husband, so he's been playing with me since 2001. And he's playing in my current band, and he played on the album. Dave Reimer has played in my band for about a decade. Well, probably a little over a decade, actually. And he's a fairly notable West Coast bass player, singer. He's played with, oh gosh, Bryan Adams in the past, Bonnie Bentall, a host of other acts that I can't think of off the top of my head. But he's and he's still sought after for session work and for his vocal prowess. He's a great singer, and his voice blends great with mine. And he did all the background vocals on the album with me. And he's played with me for about 11 years. And Sean Kelly, my current guitarist, he and I only met about 3 years ago. I used some other West Coast players up until that point, but they weren't writers. And so the idea of having a close partnership again with someone who was a writer was always in the back of my mind. I just hadn't found the right person. My former co-writer, John Albany, packed up and moved to Nashville many, many years ago now and started a studio down there. And so he produces and races cars in Nashville. So that had always been in the back of my mind. And Sean and I met over a book, believe it or not. 3 years ago, Sean was authoring a book called Metal on Ice, and it was a Canadian music history book that he was writing on a bunch of the Canadian, notable Canadian rock bands from the 80s and early 90s that really influenced him as a young person, and that have sort of sadly been rather neglected in Canadian music history annals, you know. And so we met because I did an interview for the book, and we got along really, really well, and this sort of idea came up of, you know, you should... He said, if you ever want someone to play on some Toronto shows, I'm available. I'd love to do it. I'd always love to play in your band. And so I hired him to play on a few shows about 3 years ago. And it was just, it's funny when you just play with someone and there's just a real musical conversation going on, and there's an instant chemistry. It just became apparent to all of us that, oh my gosh, Sean should be playing in the band. And so I invited him at that point to join the band. And a few months later, I started talking about the idea that I was interested in making another record, and he said, I'd love to explore writing with you, and we started bouncing some ideas around, and yeah, so we ended up co-writing a few songs on the album with me as well.
And then you said he was from Toronto originally.
That's correct. He's still in Toronto. He lives in Toronto. I live in Vancouver, but we managed to make it work. I either fly him out or we fly there for shows, and it always works out.
Now, I'd like to talk to you for just a minute about your other band, which is the one that's on the video for Tomboy.
Ha ha. Okay, sure.
They look a little bit green.
They were. They had one afternoon of air guitar. Threw them in front of a camera.
Now, one of those that was in the video was your daughter?
That's correct. The little blondie on guitar with the glasses is my daughter, Angela.
I have to assume that was probably a lot of fun to do, though. Probably took a little longer than normal just to keep everybody focused.
Surprisingly, those girls were amazing. The little girl that plays drums is a daughter of a friend of mine who does quite a bit of commercial work. And we did one rehearsal, and I I thought, okay, this is crazy. You're 12 and you're taller than me, so you're going to sit behind the drum kit. These girls, I don't know what is in the food these days, but so I put her behind a drum kit, put a drumsticks in her hand and said, okay, you got to play the snare drum on this beat and the cymbal on this beat, and I don't care if the kick drum's in time, just look like you're playing in time. And she totally rose to the occasion. I was really impressed at what she, within about 15 minutes, she was actually playing the drums. It was unbelievable. Yeah, and the rest of them, you know, we put guitars in their hands and just said, you know, just play on the beat and look like you're having fun. And, I mean, I'm assuming most people that see the video will be able to suspend reality long enough to realize it was meant in the interest of fun, right? The idea that, you know, the idea occurred to me, you know, the song is meant to be, well, the song is meant to be sort of an anthem for young people or young girls in particular as a, this sort of anti-beauty culture message, because our young women are, these days, are just inundated with sexualized images in the media, on the internet, everywhere. And I don't ever want my own daughter to feel like she has to measure up or she has to be something that she's not. And so that was sort of the inspiration of the song. And then it occurred to me, what better message to send than to actually bring a bunch of young tomboys who are comfortable in their own skin into this project and have them be in the video with me.
It turned out great. It really did. And the only reason I was thinking about, you know, how long it would take, I talked a few months ago to Bobby Hart of Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, who were the original producers for the Monkees when they first got together. And he said that one afternoon, he had all four of the guys into the studio to start doing some recording, and he went to push the button to start, and they had disappeared because all four of them were on the floor wrestling. That was the last time he had any more than one monkey into the studio at a time. So congratulations on getting getting them to stay calm and get the work done.
They were actually great, I have to say. The director was great as well, in that he knew once I got them on that white sheet of paper, the backdrop, you know, we better start rolling right away and keep them engaged. And when we would cut and have breaks, he actually had a thing in his studio called a segue. Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so they had every break, they were like, okay, let's go segue. So we had them off in another room doing their romping.
Hey, are you going out on the road to promote the album at all?
That's definitely in the cards. Right now, I've got a few summer shows on my calendar for Canada. So I think what our plan is, because it was released here first, we're starting in Canada, and we're going to go out and do some targeted festivals and some dates here. And at this point, we're sort of gauging the response to the album in the States. And I was actually talking to a New York agent a couple of days ago, and we are planning to start with a New York and an LA showcase, and build it from there. At this point in time, I know a lot of my fan base still likes to buy hard copy. And so we've been sort of doing this sort of grassroots level. I've hired a great promo guy, and I know that the email that I got a few days ago from Universal was that sales in the States and Canada are still strong. I know we are in the Amazon top 100 charts right now here for sales, so that's going quite well. So yes, touring is definitely something that we are talking about. It's not all put together right at this point in time, like I said, because we're sort of building this on a grassroots level, but yeah, the next step is to get down into New York State and to do some shows.
Oh, that's great. You know, I wanted to ask you, I know right from your first album that you were very popular in Canada and you had a lot of big fans in Europe. I understand that your first album was only available as an import, and yet you became very popular over there. And it unfortunately, it seems like you have had a harder time breaking here in the United States, which is really too bad. Was that ever a frustration for you over the years?
Well, looking back now, I think, man, that is a drag that that happened. Unfortunately, I was signed in the type of record contract with a Canadian label where they owned my foreign licensing rights, which meant that if I was going to get released in Europe or in Australia or in the United States, they were in charge of negotiating a sub-distribution deal for me. So those sub-distribution deals happened everywhere almost in the world except for the USA. And without going into a great deal of detail, there were political and contractual reasons why that didn't happen. There was definitely interest for my albums down there. Without going into a great deal of detail, that's sort of what happened. But truthfully, between having albums that were successful in Europe and in Canada, and I was so busy touring. And I was sort of on a hamster wheel of write, record, tour, write, record, tour. The sort of USA being an elusive market for me wasn't really always on my radar because I was just so busy. Looking back, in hindsight now, I think, wow, that's kind of a drag. But hey, never better late than never, hey? I mean, the reality for me is I feel like Fire and Gasoline is my best rock album ever. And it's finally available in the States, so I'm not complaining.
It is a great album. I mean, I really, really enjoyed it from, in the couple of times that I've had a chance to listen to it. So,
thank you.
What about the future? I know that right now, of course, everything is aimed at that album, but do you have any thoughts in the future as far as either recording more rock or recording more jazz blues?
You know, I don't really like to paint myself into a corner and say I'm only going to do one thing exclusively. I definitely think I have more rock albums in me. So you definitely in the future, I think, will see more original work from me. But one of the things that's in the back of my mind is to do an album of covers, but really, really unique covers. And that's all I can say at this point in time. I don't want to say too much, you know. Really, really a real sublime set list of covers of songs that really mean something to me. And so that's in the back of my mind, too.
Have you gotten into a lot of the social media that seems to be so prevalent and so needed now as far as marketing goes?
Well, I do have two Facebook pages, a Lee Aaron Facebook and a Lee Aaron fan page. And I am on Twitter at Lee Aaron Music, if people are into that. I do my best to try to keep up with it. It was really like pulling teeth with me. My web administrator would always go, "You need to tweet. You need to tweet every day." And I'm like, who cares what my dog had for breakfast? You know, I just don't. You know, like I just there's an element of it. I feel is quite shallow. You know, but
I know there's people that put up video blogs of their life every day. And I look at that and I'm like, why would I do that? It's like, get up, work, write, go to bed. You know, it's like, who's going to want to see that?
But everybody can have their 2 minutes of stardom that way, right? Everyone can be on camera. Everyone can take a selfie and, you know, manipulate it so they look their best. And this is the problem that I kind of have with social media. But at the same time, there's people that I like, you know, on social media. Like I just, believe it or not, decided I was going to, I love John Oliver. Do you know the John Oliver program, Last Week Tonight? I love John Oliver. A friend of mine said, if you love John Oliver, you should be following Albert Brooks. And I'm like, he's not really my generation, but I went and I looked at some of his comments on Twitter and I was like, okay, this guy's brilliant. I need to follow him, right? So I do like that aspect of it. And so I do my very best to keep my fans updated with social media, but no, I'm not posting something banal about my everyday life every day. If I have something interesting to say, I'll say it, but, you know, not every day is an interesting day, as we all know. You know, 2 days ago I was rushing to the clinic because my son had an ear infection. This is not something I'm going to tweet about, but people tweet it. But people tweet about stuff like that, and it's like, man, you know, there needs to be some things in your life, I think, that are still somewhat sacred. It's a fine line, I think, with artists, too, because there used to be sort of there was a divide between the artist and the audience in that there was some mystery still left about the creative process and what their day-to-day life was like and what makes them tick. And I loved that kind of mystery. And, you know, if I bought an album or a vinyl that had an inside sleeve that had a few candid photos of this is what happened in the studio or behind stage, I would just stare at it for hours and love it and hold it. But now, you know, these artists are tweeting about just like boring nuances of their everyday life. And so I kind of miss that mystery, I have to say.
Also, with something like the Kickstarter or some of the other money funding sites, that they're selling for people who contribute, you know, practically all day views into the studio process of making the album, which, as you said, takes a lot of the mystery out of it.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because there's so many crowdfunding platforms out there now, and I had looked at doing that to finance another record because the truth is record companies don't sign you and give you a big advance to do a record anymore, unless you're Beyonce, you know what I mean, or Adele. They don't. That doesn't happen. So it's like the market is saturated with those type of platforms, number one. If you don't get if you set a goal and you don't get all the money, you have to give all the money back. There's tax implications. There's all of these sort of, if you're going to administrate it yourself or even with a partner for help, and you're promising all these different fan packs and signed microphones and stuff, someone's got to follow up with all of that. And I looked at it and I just went, nah, no, I'm not, nah, way too complicated, not doing that. And I thought, so last summer my mission was go out, make enough money to pay for the record with summer shows, and give my fans just a gift. Yeah, I'm not going to make them pay for my record, you know? So that was my attitude about it.
You didn't want to go out and play a round of golf with somebody if they gave you $10,000.
Well, it just gets too complicated, I just felt. You know, I just thought, you know, my life is busy enough. I still have elementary school-age children. I don't, unless I'm actually touring, I don't have time to fly to Newfoundland to have a dinner with somebody or do a house concert at this. And not to sound elitist, but I need to be able to compartmentalize everything in my life and make it work in a framework that works for me, you know? So, and now I'm yada yadaing on, but I hear you. So it's interesting. There's a song on that album that I co-wrote with Sean called Popular. And that is all about, it's a little commentary on social media.
Well, listen, I want to really thank you for, you know, joining us here today. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you. And I do wish you all the best with your new album and, you know, with getting out on the road and all.
Well, thank you very much. It was wonderful talking to you.
Our thanks to Lee Aaron for talking with us. Her new album, Fire and Gasoline, is available in both Canada and the U.S. We'll be back soon with more editions of the VVN Music Podcast, including upcoming guest Michael Schenker. Remember that you can get the latest news on the veteran artists of rock, pop, soul, country, folk, and blues at vvnmusic.com, where you can also find back editions of our podcast with guests like Nils Lofgren, Steve Hackett, John Anderson, Marky Ramone, and Lloyd Price. If you have any comments or questions about the website or this podcast, please send them to vvnnetwork@gmail.com. Our theme music is performed by Yahar. This program was recorded on May 30th, 2016, and is a production of the VVN Network, copyright 2016.